This is WZRD Chicago. It's Tuesday morning. And we started off right once again with Democracy Now! Coming at us from our Pacifica satellite. Brought to you by the hard work and dedication from everybody that Amy just mentioned there at Democracy Now! And I really am quite certain we are still the only radio station in Chicago carrying Democracy Now! I'm not saying that proudly there should be more radio stations carrying Democracy Now! But we're happy to bring it to you with our 100 watts of power, getting it to as many people as we can. And I know a lot of you out there have been working hard to spread the word to your friends and family and co-workers that if you want the truth, you have to go to Democracy Now! You have to go to Pacifica. NPR doesn't cut it. ABC, certainly not going to bring in the truth. CBS, CNN, we just heard about. Fox, whoa. ZRD is where it's at. All right. I didn't know about this lawsuit filed in Berlin until Amy Goodman just shared it with us on her show. Let's check it out. The Pentagon made thinly veiled threats on Monday, suggesting U.S.-German relations could be at risk if a criminal complaint filed in German courts over Abu Ghraib proceeds. This off of dwworld.de, Deutsche Welle. It's a German, looks like it's a German news site in English. From December 14th, this article is. So this lawsuit was filed last month. Complaint was filed in Berlin on November 30th by the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR, and Berlin's Republican Lawyers Association on behalf of four Iraqis who were alleged to have been mistreated by U.S. soldiers. Besides Rumsfeld, Rummy Boy, former CIA Director George Tenet, Under Secretary of Defense for Intelligence Stephen Camboni, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, and five other military officers who served in Iraq were named in the complaint, which seeks an investigation into their role in the prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib. U.S.-German relations at risk. Here's a quote from Lawrence DeRita, Pentagon spokesperson. Generally speaking, says Lawrence, as is true anywhere, if these kinds of lawsuits take place with American servicemen in the crosshairs, you bet it's something we take seriously. End of quote. So you see, as they do to save their own hide, when they're accused of orchestrating the activities at Abu Ghraib, they put the soldier up in the front and say, it's not us, it's the poor behaving soldier, the lack of discipline, it's not us, it's not policy. And then here they say, if these kinds of lawsuits take place with American servicemen in the crosshairs, you bet it's something we take seriously. Continuing, Lawrence says, if you get an adventurous prosecutor who might want to seize onto one of these frivolous lawsuits, it could affect the broader relationship. I think that's probably safe to say. No talk of defense, no talk of legitimacy. Automatically, the lawsuit's frivolous. By Lawrence DeRita's standard, Pentagon spokesperson. Bet she doesn't even have a law degree, and she's calling the lawsuit frivolous. Germany, continuing with the article, Germany's home to some 70,000 U.S. troops, many of which have rotated into and out of Iraq from German bases. Sanchez, the former U.S. commander in Iraq, is stationed in Germany as commander of the Army's 5th Corps. Next paragraph, titled Universal Jurisdiction for War Crimes. The groups that filed the complaint said they had chosen Germany because of its code of crimes against international law, introduced in 2002, which grants German courts universal jurisdiction in cases involving war crimes or crimes against humanity. It also makes military or civilian commanders who fail to prevent their subordinates from committing such acts liable. That's key. Derrida, Lawrence Derrida, spokesperson Pentagon, said he did not know whether the United States had raised specific concerns directly with the German government, but he said, quote, I think every government in the world, particularly a NATO ally, understands the potential effect on relations with the United States if these kinds of frivolous lawsuits were ever to see the light of day. End of quote. Next paragraph, titled, Similar Tussle with Belgium. Last year, the United States clashed with Belgium over a similar lawsuit that allowed war crimes charges to be brought against retired General Tommy Franks, who led the U.S. invasion of Iraq, as well as numerous other international figures. The 1993 law, which empowered Belgian court to judge suspects accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, were regardless of where the alleged acts were committed, or the nationality of either the accused or of the victims. Again, international jurisdiction. Rummy Boy threatened to block funding for a new NATO headquarters in Belgium over the law and said the United States was considering whether it would continue to send officials to meetings in Brussels as long as the law was in place. Talk about strong arm. The Belgian parliament replaced the law with a watered-down version in August 2003, and its high court threw out lawsuits against Franks, George Herbert Walker Bush, 41, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, all lawsuits against them thrown out, indicating the U.S. planned to play a similar game of hardball with Germany. Rummy has informed the German government via the U.S. Embassy that he will not take part in the annual Munich Security Conference coming up next month, well, coming in February, should the investigation proceed. So this article from December, see if we can find an update. Crimes against humanity, war crimes against Rummy himself, and many other, including Stephen Camboni, Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, Brigadier General Janis Karpinski, and 5 other military officers. War crimes, crimes against humanity. You heard the stories of the way we're treating prisoners in Guantanamo. We know what's going down in Abu Ghraib. We know what's happened in Afghanistan. We know what happens here in our own prisons. As our standards began to be dragged, continue to be dragged through the mud, our standing around the world continues to decline. What's the future gonna hold if we don't take back control of this out-of-control executive branch of our government? And I think that's the key. The executive branch has too much power, and Congress is giving it all to them, including every dollar they spend. And this is what they're doing with it. Crimes against humanity, war crimes, invading other countries, expanding CIA, torturing people, propping up dictators to serve their interest. And some would argue, ours, but certainly not I. Some music coming at you, stay tuned. We're going to hear, I'm going to go to C-SPAN website and download the debates when Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones from Ohio contested the electoral votes from Ohio in the Senate last week. And Barbara Boxer, Senator from California, stood tall with her and triggered the law that sends them back to their chambers for 2 hours of debate. This is WZRD Chicago. It's 88.3, home of Freeform Radio. So happy to be part of your day. Enjoy it. It's kind of balmy out there, and the big time deep freeze is coming. I've got some family coming up from Arizona, and one of them hasn't really experienced winter in the north, believe it or not. Been an Arizona guy his entire life. And he wanted to come see Chicago in the winter, and they're arriving on Friday, just in time for the sub-zero stuff. Yeah. So, that's it. Dig it. Stay with us. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your neighbors. WZRD is the place to be. And if you have trouble getting us in, and we fade in and out, we are only 100 watts. Get yourself an FM booster, a new antenna. Find a way to make it happen. Keep us alive and spread the word. This is the Texas Polka, dedicated to George W. Bush and all his friends and family. We'll be right back. The Texas Polka on WZRD Chicago, going out to Big Dan Meyer over in Ohio. Viva la Texas Polka! And the amazing thing is that this is Tejano Polka. These are Latinos, Mexicanos, Tejanos, man, Tejanos playing this polka, and it's obviously German influence, so you understand where Mexico gets their mariachi sound, their big band, their tuba, their rhythms that comes from Germany, and many, many, many Germans settled there in the crutch of the Gulf in the Rio Grande Valley there. There's still communities down in southern Texas that are high German population with German festivals, and you look in the phone book and you see lots of German names, and that's the history. Speaking of history, bad segue. Last week, Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones and Senator Barbara Boxer made history by joining together to contest the electoral delegates from the state of Ohio. The 20 electors cast their vote for George W. Bush. And we're going to play some speeches from the Senate debate. We'll play the speech of Barbara Boxer. She was the first senator to speak, since she was the one who rose in contention. But first, a little bit of history about contested presidential elections from a website called jurist.law.pitt. Looks like Pittsburgh University presidential election law. Election roulette. It's a commentary by Professor William G. Gross from the Cumberland School of Law at Samford. It says S-A-M, Samford University. And it begins with a quote from John Burgess from 1888 in an article called The Law of the Electoral Count. This is in the Political Science Quarterly in 1888, written by John Burgess. Here's the quote that Professor Ross begins his article with. Quote, "The most complicated bit of governmental machinery which the modern world has to exhibit is that which is employed in the selection of chief executive officer for the United States. It is almost marvelous that any people should have preserved political unity for a century under such a loose and decentralized system of election and its chief magistrate." Professor William G. Ross begins his article then. "Every 4 years for nearly two centuries, the United States has played the political equivalent of Russian roulette when it has conducted a presidential election. This year, the gun finally exploded. How much injury it has inflicted on the body politic is not yet clear." The House of Representatives selection of a president in 1824, the disputed election of 1876, and the close and questionable Kennedy-Nixon contest of 1960 have all received much attention in recent weeks as news media have grasped for examples of other elections that have caused trouble. Many Americans are unaware that a remarkably large number of these elections have produced close results that nearly created political chaos. If you haven't figured it out already, this article is from early 2001, but certainly appropriate here in early 2005. Deja vu. The very first seriously contested presidential election was in 1800. It was thrown into the House of Representatives after an electoral college tie between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. They resulted from a double balloting anomaly in the Constitution. Jefferson was elected only after much maneuvering. The 1800 election produced one positive result, aside from Jefferson's victory. That's a sidebar from Professor Ross. Insofar as it led to the 1804 enactment of the 12th Amendment, which eliminated double balloting. The amendment retained, however, the curious procedure for election by the House of Representatives, voting by states, when no candidate receives a majority of the electoral vote. When no candidate received a majority of electors in 1824, the House elected John Quincy Adams, even though Andrew Jackson had received a plurality of both the popular and electoral votes. Wow. In four more elections during the next half century, 1836, 1856, and 1860, the shift of a relatively small number of votes in a few states would have thrown the election into the House of Representatives. In six other elections, 1828, 1840, 1844, 48, 64, and 68, the shift of a small number of votes in a few states, fewer than 20,000 in the first four, would have resulted in the election of the other candidate. In most of these situations, the winning candidate would not have received a plurality of the popular vote. In three of these elections, 36, 44, and 60, the final outcome was determined by the electoral votes of only one state, New York. So we see many elections in the 1800 riddled with controversy and ambiguity and uncertainty. And the democracy has survived, some would argue, barely. In 1876, Professor Ross's article continues, in 1876, the outcome of the election between Republican Rutherford B. Hayes and Democrat Samuel Tilden was in doubt for months as the result of the submission of double slates of electors in four states, which means that the electors for Hayes and the electors for Tilden both came forth in four different states. In Florida, in Florida, where both Republicans and Democrats alleged fraud, the governor certified Hayes electors, but a court ruled in favor of Tilden electors. In South Carolina, where fraud allegations also were rampant, Democrats submitted a slate of electors even though state officials had certified the Republican electors. In Louisiana, which had two governors, there were two competing canvassing boards and two conflicting states' sets of returns. And in Oregon, one Republican elector was challenged on a technicality. Congress eventually settled the dispute only by creating an electoral commission composed of eight Republicans, seven Democrats, who voted on strict party lines, making Hayes the winner by the margin of one vote, even though he had lost the popular vote. That was in 1876, almost 130 years ago. So only 4 years after the notorious election of 1876, the now largely forgotten election of 1880 nearly produced another crisis. Republican James A. Garfield's victory over Democrat Winfield Scott Hanek hinged on Garfield's capture of New York's 35 electors, which Garfield won by a margin of only 20,000 votes. Rumors of Republican vote fraud in New York were rampant during the days following the election, and the chairman of the Democratic National Committee and the leader of the Tammany Hill seriously considered contesting the election. This is 1880. Hanek did not concede for 5 days, and even then he publicly suggested that vote fraud had occurred in New York. Yeah, where's the leader like that today? Let me read that again. Hancock did not concede for 5 days, and even then he publicly suggested that vote fraud had occurred in New York. Although Hanek believed for the remainder of the life that Garfield's victory was fraudulent, a book about the 1880 election has concluded that Hancock's essential conservatism caused him to acquiesce in the results. That sentence is beyond me. In particular, Hanek probably feared that turmoil would be particularly injurious to the nation so soon after the turbulence of the 1876 election. Moreover, the reputation of the Republican Hayes administration for honesty and efficiency also may have made a Democratic contest of the election impracticable. Although no one knows whether the outcome of the 1880 was really the product of fraud, a Republican diplomat stationed in South Africa had written to Garfield during the summer of 1880 to propose that the GOP import 9,000 voters into New York on Election Day from heavily Republican states to adjourn New York, and another 6,000 from Canada. No reply from Garfield is known. That was in 1880. Gilded Age presidential politics was a dicey affair. Like the election of 1880, the elections of both 1884 and 1888 hinged on the outcome in New York. 1884, Grover Cleveland defeated James Blaine in New York by a margin of barely 1,000 out of more than a million cast votes. Cleveland, he won the nation's popular vote by only 23,000 votes. In 1888, Cleveland was defeated by Benjamin Harris, who carried New York by a margin of only 1%. Cleveland, however, won by more than 100,000 popular votes nationwide. So the Electoral College has a history of shafting the popular voice. It's not one man, one vote. In the election of the selection of chief executive officer. 1916, another election hinged on a narrow vote in only one state. Woodrow Wilson, Democrat, defeated Republican Charles Evans Hughes by only 3,000 votes in California, where 13 electoral votes tipped the election to Wilson. Since Hughes carried most of the East, many newspapers declared Hughes the victor in early editions on the morning after, and were embarrassed as the television networks, as embarrassed as the television networks in the 2000 election were when returns from the Midwest and West threw the election into doubt. And of course, Woodrow Wilson won. For another 2 days, the outcome was uncertain. While votes were counted slowly in variously closely contested states, especially in California, which the Democrats had at first conceded to the Republicans, and in which the ballot format retarded tabulation efforts. Meanwhile, the national chairman of both parties retained legal counsel in anticipation of litigation over the election. The Democratic chairman wired state and country chairman, state and county chairmen in various states to warn that Republicans were desperate and urged that they personally guard the safety of ballot boxes. In words that could have been written during the past month, the American Review of Reviews in December 1916 observed that, quote, a presidential election is to be decided by the result in a single state where the vote is so close as to be in doubt for a number of days. It is not surprising that there should be anxiety as well as suspense. End of quote. Hughes did not concede until more than 2 weeks after the election. When Wilson finally received Hughes' telegram, he dryly remarked that, quote, it was a little moth-eaten, but quite legible. Meaning old, I think. The story continues with more history of the 1900s and the 1960 election, of course. 1960, a shift of only about 4,000 votes in Illinois and fewer than 25,000 votes in Texas would have enabled Richard M. Nixon to defeat John F. Kennedy. Since Harry F. Byrd received the electoral votes of 14 unpledged electors from Mississippi and Alabama, plus the vote of faithless elector from Oklahoma, the election would have been thrown into the House if Kennedy had lost either Illinois or Texas. Whoa. Harry F. Byrd received the electoral votes of 14 unpledged electors from Mississippi and Alabama. Wow. Harry Byrd must have been running as independent, and he got 14 electoral votes. That's pretty good. Rumors of fraud in numerous states, particularly close divided Illinois and Texas, encouraged Republicans to consider contesting the election. Since Nixon conceded to Kennedy on the day after the election and later encouraged the belief that he had stood aside only in order to prevent a constitutional crisis, many commentators in the wake of the 2000 pointed to Nixon's prompt concession as an example of good sportsmanship, often with the implication that Gore should be so magnanimously acquiescent. The myth that Nixon simply rolled over and played dead was recently shattered, however, by David Greenberg, a columnist for the online magazine Slate. Greenberg has demonstrated that Republicans investigated vote fraud charges, demanded recounts in 11 states, and filed lawsuits in Illinois, Georgia, and Texas. Popular vote was also very close, with Kennedy receiving an official plurality of only 112,000 votes. 68, 76, it goes on and on and on. A little bit of history about contested elections. This was submitted December 4th, 2000 by William G. Gross. He teaches constitutional law and constitutional history at Cumberland School of Law, Samford University, Birmingham, Alabama. Graduated from Harvard in 1979. If you want to email him, it's jurist, J-U-R-I-S-T, at law.pitt.edu. That's law.pitt with two T's dot E-D-U. And history was made again last week thanks to Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones and Senator Barbara Boxer, so they contested the results from Ohio. Here's the debate in the Senate. The way this law works, this is what happened. I was watching it in the Senate, and they go through an alphabetical order and they read the results from each state. There's just a few senators there, and Dr. Evil himself, Dick Cheney, is chairing the thing. And they get the piece of paper and they say, this great state of Alabama has submitted their results. Everything appears to be in order and right. And they cast 6 electoral votes for George W. Bush and 6 electoral votes for Vice President Dick Cheney. And then, you know, they do this state by state by state. They get to Ohio. And they read Ohio, 20 votes to George W. Bush, 20 votes to Vice President Dick Cheney. And Stephanie Tubbs Jones, with Barbara Boxer sitting right next to her, rises. And Dick Cheney says, for what reason does the congressperson rise? And she says, I rise to contest the electoral votes from the state of Ohio. And I have the signature of a senator. Boom. So this automatically triggers each branch of the, each division of the House of the Congress to go back to their respective chambers. The House of Representatives goes back to their chambers. The Senate convenes in their chambers, and they each have 2 hours to debate. They can end earlier, but 2 hours to debate. So here's Senator Barbara Boxer. She was the first one to speak in the Senate. This is WZRD Chicago.
Mr. President.
Senator from California.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. For most of us in the House and in the Senate, we have spent our lives fighting for things we believe in, always fighting to make our nation better. We may not agree from time to time, but we're always fighting to make our nation better. We have fought for social justice. We have fought for economic justice. We have fought for environmental justice. We have fought for criminal justice. Now we must add a new fight, the fight for electoral justice. Every citizen of this, the greatest country in the world, who is registered to vote should be guaranteed that their vote matters, that their vote is counted, that in the voting booth in their community, their vote has as much weight as any senator, any congressperson, any president, any cabinet member, or any CEO of any Fortune 500 corporation. And I am sure that every one of my colleagues agrees with that statement, that in the voting booth, everyone is equal. So now it seems to me that under our great Constitution of the United States of America, that we swear allegiance to uphold, which guarantees the right to vote, that we must ask certain questions. First, why did voters in Ohio wait hours in the rain to vote? Why were voters at Kenyon College, for example, made to wait in line until 4 a.m. to vote? Because there were only 2 machines for 1,300 voters when they needed 13. Excuse me. Why did voters in poor and predominantly African-American communities have disproportionately long waits? Why in Franklin County did election officials use only 2,798 machines when they needed 5,000? Why did they hold back 68 machines in warehouses, 68 machines that were in working order? Why were 42 of those machines predominantly in African American communities? Why did in the Columbus area alone an estimated 5,000 to 10,000 voters leave polling places out of frustration without having voted? How many more never bothered to vote after they heard this? Because they had to take care of their families, or they had a job, or they were sick, or their legs ached after waiting for hours. Why is it when 638 people voted at a precinct in Franklin County, a voting machine awarded 4,258 extra votes to George Bush? Thankfully, they fixed it. Only 628 people had shown up, but George Bush got more than 4,000 votes. How could that happen? Why did Franklin County officials reduce the number of electronic voting machines in downtown precincts while adding them into the suburbs? This also led to long lines. In Cleveland, where there were thousands of provisional ballots disqualified, why, when everyone knew that poll workers had given faulty instructions to the voters? Because of this and voting irregularities in so many other places, I joined today with Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones, a 10-year judge, an 8-year prosecutor, a 6-year member of Congress, a woman inducted into the Women's Hall of Fame. Folks, she has great credibility. And she asked just one senator to take a couple of hours. I hate inconveniencing my friends, but I think it's worth a couple of hours to shine some light on these issues. Here's the thing. We passed HAVA. That was important, the Help America Vote Act. But then we did nothing. Senators Graham, Clinton, and I introduced a bill to ensure a paper trail goes along with electronic voting. We couldn't even get a hearing in that last Congress. Over in the House, it's the same problem. We need this kind of bill. So let me simply say to my colleagues, I have great respect for all of you, but I think it's key that whether we're Republicans or Democrats, we understand that the centerpiece of this country is democracy. And the centerpiece of democracy is ensuring the right to vote. And I ask you, my friends, from both sides of the aisle, when we get busy working in the next few weeks, let us not turn away from the things that happened in Ohio. Our people are dying all over the world, a lot from my state. For what reason? To bring democracy to the far corners of the world. Let's fix it here, and let's do it first thing out. Thank you very much, Mr. President. I yield the floor.